the show.
Welcome to this week's episode of The Boundless Show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. I apologize in advance for a bad cold that I have that I don't think I got from anyone here, but I'm hoping to pass it on.
Which is not so contagious,
It's
correct?
Not contagious.
So none of y'all out there will be catching this.
You shouldn't catch it just by listening to this podcast, I'm hoping.
But who's ever medically qualified to say it's not contagious? Don't people just say that out of good intentions?
Yeah, well, because we don't want to use our sick time, so we just come in. No, but literally, I've had this
thing
for 5 or 6 days.
She wants to use her sick time for the psychological help days.
I want to get sick so I can use my sick time.
Exactly. Yeah, you want to get sick? Yeah, well, you know, here I am, just sick. But that's okay. I'm just coughing and have kind of a bad voice, but that's okay. But we want to celebrate Father's Day this week, which is exciting. Does anyone have any good dad stories to share?
Well, I have the best dad in the world, I just want to say. From
who also going back was your Valentine, so I knew
that's
I remember
right.
that.
That's
so
right.
Obviously
Which
he's
is
awesome.
One of the reasons he's the best dad in the world.
Yeah.
And so to honor him, we loved to make him breakfast in bed. And the way you know he's the best dad in the world is that he used to, with a smile on his face, drink the entire cup of air quotes coffee we made him with several scoops of coffee, not Sanka or anything instant. This was real coffee grinds that we would just put into a cup of hot tap water and stir.
Nice.
And he was so sweet. He would be so excited to have our little drawings and have his cup of coffee. And he would just always be blessed by that. So, Dad, I love you, and I wish I could bring you some real coffee this Sunday.
Well, Livy and Ava and Savannah have the greatest dad in the world.
And who are they, Ted?
They're my kids.
My dad was like the uber conservative. My dad, actually, it's going on 7 years since my dad died of cancer. And I was trying to think of, I wrote a tribute for him, actually, for his memorial service that I don't know where it is. I have it on my computer, but I actually have the hard copy, too. So someday I'll have to read that, at least for my mom's sake, I guess, because I'm sure she would like that. But my dad was an uber conservative, and he was almost 50 when I was born, actually. So I remember for one Father's Day, I got him a shirt that literally was like purple and aqua. Like it was really loud and it was really cool. And this was probably like late 80s. And so for the time, it was really cool. And my dad had white hair. He had white hair for as long as I knew him. And so he opened it and he's like, you know, and he was trying to be really polite about it. But it was just like, there's no way in God's green earth I'm ever going to put this thing on my body. And but we convinced him to wear it that night when we went out to dinner, just, and he did as a concession. And I'm not kidding, in the first hour, like 5 women came up to him and were like, "That shirt looks so fabulous on you." And after that, he wore it for like everything. We couldn't even get it off him. So,
well, I will say that our kids have been plotting in secret to honor Steve for Father's Day because he carries on the greatest dad ever tradition. And thankfully, they do know how to make real coffee. And so we will probably both wake up to freshly brewed, hot, legitimate, the right amount coffee on Sunday
morning.
Well,
I'm just excited because that's the one Sunday where I get to go to Kentucky Fried Chicken if I want to. Because, I mean,
chicken wings.
A Southern boy trying to adapt to a wife from Ohio.
Who, I never have learned how to make it.
She can't make the KFC formula too
We
well.
Actually have been to KFC every Father's Day since we got married, since we had kids.
Wow.
And that's
the
only time we ever go.
Good tradition.
That is hilarious. That's awesome. As we wrap up this chat, we want to let you know that today's music is provided by the band Riley. They're a band out of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We had the chance to meet them at New Attitude as they took the Boundless stage. So we hope you enjoy what they have to offer. If you want to find out more info about the band, go to boundless.org.
Father, we've proved we know not what we do. We're spinning round and round, wondering what is up and what is down. Ashamed, confused by twisted things we do. You came to change the ways, clean the stains of the crooked man. It's time we listen to what you're asking for.
Roundtable, we are actually going to kick off. Did you guys see in the news? There was actually, this is just appalling. It's funny how, you know, something hits the news and everyone forwards it to you and you can kind of get the collective, this is so disgusting, from people. But I'm sure everyone's heard about the story out of Connecticut where the man was actually, a 78-year-old man was hit by a car, flipped into the air basically like a rag doll and landed in the street. And for almost 5 minutes, people passed him by. Hello, Good Samaritan story, modern day. Passed him by and did not assist him. And it was caught on tape by like a traffic camera. And so this whole thing plays out on tape and now it's on YouTube and stuff. And one of the headlines like of one of the Connecticut papers just screamed out something like how ridiculous or how terrible are the people of Connecticut that no one can stop by and help their own fellow citizen or whatever. And so my friends emailed that to me and they were just like, can you even believe this? And we were like, yeah, no, it's totally ridiculous. And it kind of just speaks to how, why are we laughing?
Yeah, no.
I think you're being too hard on the nutmeggers up in Connecticut. Seriously, I mean, you're told, if somebody gets hurt like that and they're laying down, okay, they could have stopped traffic, they could have come out there and surrounded
him. So it was a hit and run, the guy who
hit a hit and run.
Wow.
You could see on the video that there are two cars trying to pass a car and they're racing or something.
Oh my goodness.
And the car that's behind the first car hits the guy and it really does look terrible. And then you see all these people standing around doing nothing.
Did he
As a matter of fact, nobody even called 911.
Well, and that's it. Not only was it a hit and run, but the people that even went, like people went and like circled the guy, people went and checked him out, but no one stopped and helped. No one called. It was just them there. And it's kind of the idea of everyone thinks that everyone else is going to do something.
Yeah.
I saw a video a couple days ago of this guy who like loses it in an office. And he throws his monitor at somebody and he starts kicking papers around, finds a shovel or something from somewhere and starts hitting computers. And this office space has maybe 20 people in it and everybody just sort of standing back looking at this guy as he trashes stuff, hits people. And I'm thinking, where are the men? Mm-hmm. You know, why doesn't somebody stop this, tackle the guy? And it's related to what you're talking about. Here's this older gentleman who's on the ground, in the road, you know, where are the people? Where are the women? Where are the men that are going to walk up and tend to the guy? You know, are you okay? Can I help you? Can I, know?
So there are extreme circumstances like that. And then there are also, you know, we could apply this to what we've talked about recently, just that Mott and I in our church recently had what I could only call a plea, basically, from the woman who is in charge of our children's ministry for summer Sunday school teachers for the kids. Now, we go to a church that has 1,500 people in it, and if you need to, like, practically, you know, prostitute yourself to get people to sign up to teach Sunday school, I mean, that is just sad. And we were asking ourselves, you know, why is that? Why does everyone think that everyone else is going to step in and fill these positions and do the stuff that needs to be done?
Yeah.
And why do you all think that is?
Well, our pastor talked about that in a sermon he gave just a couple of weeks ago, and he blamed it in part on the rise in a focus on spiritual gifts in today's evangelicalism. And he said that if you focus too much on your spiritual gift, you also focus on what's not your gift. And when opportunities to serve arise, you make the excuse, that's not my gift. So I think that's part of it.
And isn't it a luxury to be able to operate in your gifts? Meaning it's only when everything's getting done that you have the luxury of getting people lined up with what they're really gifted for. But if you've got something sitting there and no one's lining up for it, then shouldn't somebody have to kind of stretch themselves beyond their spiritual gifts to get it done? Because, for instance, and, you know, a church that's got to have help getting people parked. How many people have really done the assessment and identified that parking lot attendant is their spiritual gift?
Well, yeah, the irony is that teaching is a spiritual gift. It's one of the, you know, one of the big ones that you see in the New Testament. And so there are people gifted to teach at your church. There are people like that at every church. From my own experience and knowing how little I am involved, I think the bigger problem is people just aren't serving. Yeah. Because if everybody were serving, you'd actually probably have a pretty good shot at getting a job that you felt like you could contribute something valuable to that was a good fit for who you are. But if nobody's serving and every job's open, suddenly, you know, you're left with that issue of being plugged into something that you don't really resonate with.
And everybody should be serving. He says that, you know, it's the best way to find your spiritual gift is to serve and not by reading books on spiritual gifts.
I think another thing is that a lot of people are afraid of change. You know, for the first 10 years, you may not have served. Somebody else took care of it. 15 years, somebody else took care of it. 20 years, somebody else takes care of it. But at some point, you've got to change your mind. You've got to commit to serving your church. And that takes, you know, making a decision to change the status quo.
You know, I think about my dad when we, growing up, he started a church. And so he and my mom, regardless of what their gifts were, I mean, they were gifted in teaching and music and things like that. But starting that church, he had to do it all. So he was a pastor and a Sunday school teacher, and he was a carpenter, and he ran the food bank and did the jail and the prison ministry. And many times I saw him scrub the toilets. And he could have easily said, that's not my gift. But you don't, once again, you don't have the luxury when things have to get done.
Yeah.
But you know, I think it's important to stretch this beyond even the church walls. And I think it comes back down to the question Jesus asked, who is my neighbor? And you mentioned the Good Samaritan, and that was the question that was asked in the midst of that parable. Because in the context of the guy that's hit by the car, or whether it's a need in a church, we're constantly reminded that we have to determine who our neighbor is, and we can't be like the people Jesus was talking to who tried to find a legal loophole to not serve their neighbor. I mean, that's exactly what that conversation was about.
Yeah, and to do it when it's just convenient or when it serves you. Our pastor actually quoted G.K. Chesterton, who said, you know, anything worth doing is worth doing badly, which I think is a good, it's good to apply as far as, you know, when you are just experimenting or finding out, you know, what, well, basically you need to look at stuff and say, okay, what actually needs to be done.
Yeah.
And sometimes you just have to jump in and do it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes doing stuff badly helps you determine what things you can maybe gravitate towards that might be more within your.
So if this man needed CPR, it's good to do it badly.
I would rather have someone pounding on my chest for 8 pulses instead of 5 than not doing it at all. That's what I would
Well,
think,
or just to put a jacket under his head and offer him some water. I mean, you know, certainly to call 911.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, there's another quote by Winston Churchill who says that sometimes it's not enough to do your best. You should do what's required.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of another way of saying the same thing, but it's a reminder that there are things that are required, and that if you're spending too much time on the sidelines doing an assessment test and trying to figure out what your giftings and talents and all those things are, there probably needs being unmet.
You know, this is another little bit of a TED-like tangent, but I think the fact that...
Chicken wings.
That's right. The fact that we spend an increasingly large portion of our lives in homes without children has an effect on how we relate in crisis situations, because I know when I'm out driving and the kids hear a siren, they engage with that, and we have a little ritual of praying for the people in trouble and praying for the rescue workers. And I don't even hear the sirens, and the kids will say, "Mommy, pray." And I'll say, "What?" And they'll say, "The sirens." But if we see somebody in trouble, kids have a way of not only saying, "Are we going to help?" but just always being aware that they're watching. You know, if somebody gives me the wrong change in the grocery store, I have to say something, especially if the kids are there, because they are watching me. And I think kids have a way of pushing us toward our better selves.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
if
good.
We spend so much time without little kids in our lives, we have a tendency to kind of be more selfish.
They're less self-conscious.
That's right.
They don't worry how it looks if they're going out to, you know, engage with someone who's laying in the middle of the street. And so I think you're right.
I mean, they would at minimum say, "Mommy, what just happened?" What, you know, I mean, they would engage with that in a way that you don't if you're just walking down the street on your way to a business meeting.
People are told not to handle or jostle someone who's just been hit or thrown up in the air by a car because of a spinal injury, right? So,
But just standing around watching and not picking up your cell phone, I mean,
how
many of those people had cell phones?
I'm sure most of them. But it was a minute and a half and nothing had happened. This guy was still laying in the street. And the only reason he was helped is because a police car rode by and saw him laying in the middle of the road on the way to another call.
So don't you all see it as an adventure to inject yourself in a situation where there's a need, whether it's a need of somebody who's lying on the road in the middle, you know, that's just been hit by a car, or where there's a need with serving the Sunday school classes.
Yeah, but I don't think too many people see Sunday school as an adventure because they don't see what's at stake.
Well, it's a stretch outside their comfort zone, maybe.
Yeah, I think if people would begin to realize that a lot of what's going on in the spiritual realm isn't that much different from someone who's been hit by a car and on the street, and that there usually are needs that great in churches that they could be serving. But it is so easy to be on the sidelines. This is a sideline culture. We are passive consumers.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's a large part of why people sit on the sidelines at church are consumers.
Getting in the game, getting involved is where life happens.
Well, and that's where we're called into a faith that's incarnational, which means that Christ is actually living and active through our hands and feet and being out there in real life, earthy, messy things. But I think the whole desire to explore spiritual gifts and grow deep into God is an internal focus that so many of us are tempted towards because there is no objective requirement put on us, just our spiritual edification and forgetting that God calls us to be his hands and feet.
That's another point our pastor made. He said that the focus on spiritual gifts is it's all about self-discovery today and not about what it's supposed to be about, serving God, serving the
church.
It's
almost like what you can put on your spiritual resume instead of actually meeting a need, because every time God gives any giftings, it's because there's a need out there. And the idea is that you're in the body because you're going to match up your ability to serve with someone's need to be served.
Okay, well, that's a good reminder for us as singles and anyone, I guess, really the need to be out and about and to be open and to be just looking for opportunities to serve, whether it's an immediate need or whether it's something that you know is necessary within your church or within your neighborhood, within your own family. I think as people step up, that encourages other people to do the same. And obviously, we don't have, as singles, we don't have kids in the back of the minivan telling us what to do, so we have to be prompting one another to do that. So, anyway, it's a good reminder.
She's looking through the door, past the hills at the sunshine rising. She's listening for the sound of a piece she is yet to find. And I know I can't keep her here. Angels, they were meant to fly, but I've already turned blue. Knowing it won't be the same way without you. But I've already turned blue. Knowing it won't be the same day I'm used to.
For today's culture segment, I have with me in the studio Ted Slater. And Ted is here because he wrote a blog post this week that
has garnered some attention.
Has created quite a stir.
Well, with the title like Christianity Today Relishes Sexual Perversion,
yeah,
of course you're going to draw some heated discussion.
Exactly. Calling out CT related to the movie Sex and the City, otherwise known as SATC.
SATC.
So just tell us, Ted, give us a little bit of background as to why in reading their review, because it was their review really that you read and responded to, what did you find so egregious about it?
Sure. Earlier in the week, they published a review of this movie that was very glowing. It used terms like refreshing and enjoyed. Here are a couple of lines from the review on ChristianityToday.com. For years, good church-going friends of mine secretly raved about Sex and the City. They told me that I, a 30-something single woman, would appreciate the randy little show. I was a late adopter. It was refreshing to have a single woman's sexuality acknowledged in stark contrast. The last time anyone in a Christian setting spoke to the fact that I'm a sexual human being was in a college church group where I was blithely instructed that true love awaits. The last line is, I certainly enjoyed this meaningful reunion with its beloved characters and their winning friendships. This movie is presented in positive terms. It acknowledges some things that that are maybe inappropriate for Christians. A number of people wrote letters to the editor complaining that it received such a positive review. It got a better review than Prince Caspian, for example.
What I think is especially odd about this is that they're basically throwing this movie out as something that Christian women can and should identify with. Like, I don't send, and I never did watch the show either. I have friends who who said, you know, well, when the show was on HBO, I didn't watch it. But now that it went to, you know, it was the cleaned up version and they started watching it. And I have several friends, as I said, in a past show who were planning to go see the movie. I haven't seen or haven't heard if they have done that yet. But, you know, really, is there anything in Sex and the City that Christian women should identify with? Certainly we can't. I mean, most of us don't live in Manhattan. We don't wear designer labels. We don't, you know, couture. We don't. It's just, it's a little bit odd juxtaposition that we're supposed to dig through this movie and find something, where, you know, oh, it's about girlfriends. Well, you know, there are a lot of things out there about girlfriends.
See,
so.
I think there's a legitimate struggle that you have with movies. You can always find something redemptive in any movie, even the worst of the worst. But at what point does what you get out of it justify sitting through some really bad imagery and dialogue and worldview? From the defense of the review, the editors write, "We totally understand why many people would have no desire to see Sex and the City, choosing to avoid it because of its portrayals of pre- and extramarital sex and rampant materialism. But to slam us for reviewing the film makes no sense." The thing is, they weren't reviewing it. They were promoting it. They go on to say, "Some folks believe that when it comes to a movie like Sex and the City, there should be no choice. They've decided that no one should see it, period, at least no one who calls themselves a Christian." And that's called a straw man argument. When they present some fallacious, phony perspective of those who wish to practice media discernment that encourage others to consider not viewing this movie, and when they present them as wackos like this that want to censor everything and call for boycotts, it's easy to dismiss that kind of, you know, person who wants to practice or encourage media discernment.
So, Ted, since posting your blog post, you've received quite a few comments. You also were linked to by Tim Challies, and so it's picked up beyond the Boundless sphere as well. What kind of comments have you been receiving to your own blog post?
I'd say 80% are affirming our concern that Christianity Today would support such a movie and, in effect, encourage people to view it. 20% are disapproving of either my tone, which is admittedly pretty stern, or they're disagreeing with the degree that I'm encouraging media discernment, that I'm saying that this movie is, the positive messages that you might get from it aren't worth the cost of viewing it.
Huh. That's interesting. I mean, it reminds me of when we went out and had our discussion about eHarmony several weeks back, where it was just kind of like, you know, okay, eventually you have to say something. You know, the response that we got back from eHarmony was, well, this is real life, so we're just trying to address things as they are in real life. And I'm sure that that would be the movie studio's, you know, response, and perhaps even CT would say, you know, hey, this movie reflects that, and maybe there are some good things in it. But again, it's how far do you go in entertainment?
And admittedly, that's up to the individual to decide. You know, some people, for example, can watch Passion of the Christ. Others, it's just too much for them. And that's fine. We each have to practice media discernment. One of the comments in the blog brought up that there's a value in being familiar with this kind of cultural phenomenon so that you can interact more effectively with non-Christians. And again, there's some legitimacy to that, but at the same time, I wonder if how much contemporary vulgar media Jesus interacted with in order to have an effective conversation with the woman at the well, for example. Probably didn't spend too much time in brothels, for example, in order to speak with this woman.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I think, too, just as we, you know, as I think, for example, I have a niece who's in high school here in town, and I would never stand in line at a movie theater to go see Sex and the City, knowing that either, you know, maybe she was there going to see another movie, or I certainly would never bring her along with me. And it's just, it's again, it's a disconnect. It's you can celebrate, you know, sisterhood and girlfriends and all this kind of stuff. You can celebrate the fun of shopping, but you can do it without putting money, without supporting Sex and the City at the box office. I mean, to me, it's just weird.
Let me close out this section by encouraging our listeners to go to PluggedInOnline.com. They're the movie review site associated with Focus on the Family. And they go to all the popular movies, even the ones that you suspect are going to be trashy, such as this one. They take the bullet for me so that I'm equipped to make a decision whether to see something or not. In this case, I won't be seeing Sex and the City. But I appreciate their reviews. They do identify positive elements, forgiveness and so on. But they also point out where the movie lacks not only the obvious ones in the area of sexuality and materialism, but also that the forgiveness that's conveyed through this movie is not real forgiveness. It's not repentance, but more, I'm sorry that you took it that way. It's really thoughtful reviews at PluggedInOnline.com, and hopefully we'll all grow in the area of media discernment.
Great. Well, keep us posted as the furor around the blog progresses and we get more comments. I'm sure we'll certainly keep our listeners posted as to what's going on with this. So that is this week's culture segment. Thanks so much, Ted, for joining us.
My pleasure.
I'm starting over, completely over. I've had enough of this dissonance and pain. I've walked away with my head held straight, numb to the hum and the whispers of your grace.
In this week's edition of The Hungry Years, we learn from Kara Schwab how her own running of marathons has taught her a lot about the Christian life.
The Summer Olympics are coming up, and boy, do I love watching them. I get so motivated to embrace life and go for the gold, just like the athletes on the screen. The athletes' courage, determination, and discipline, their triumphant human spirit, it just makes me want to put down my bowl of ice cream and try to do some sit-ups during the commercials. Watching athletes compete makes me feel like I can do anything. Like even if I were to try to tackle the laundry, I could win. I think it was an Ironman race I watched on TV one afternoon that really got me thinking. I remember standing up, brushing the potato chip crumbs off my belly, and saying, "Hey, I can do this. I should run a marathon." Now at the time, I couldn't even run around my block. I could, but only with the grace and agility equal to my gas-filled Boston Terrier, with one of his paws caught in the neck of his winter sweater. And of course, after finishing the lap, I'd be huffing and carrying on like a crotchety, venomous-tongued old lady who smoked a pack a day since she was 10. I knew I needed help and a plan. So I went to the bookstore and I looked for a training guide, and there were a gazillion of them on the shelf. But suddenly, one spine in particular caught my eye, and I instantly knew I had a winner. It was entitled, The Non-Runner's Marathon Trainer. How strange to be so excited to admit that I was a non-runner who had the audacity to want to train for a marathon. But I couldn't be more thrilled. The book could have been titled, Totally Out of Shape, Wannabe Fit Person with a Wild Hair to Run a Marathon As If. I would have even brought that one up to the cashier with a skip in my step. Well, that was 3 years ago, and I'm proud to say I just ran my fourth marathon last Sunday, and I'm going to run my fifth in December. Can you believe it? I can't. But trust me, if I can run one, anyone can. It's all about commitment, training, determination, and having the faith to finish. It's actually a great metaphor for the Christian life. I learned a lot about myself training these races and transforming myself. And in this day of quick fixes, a marathon is a slow journey. You just can't cram for that kind of test. During one race, I was astonished to see and swiftly pass a virile and fit-looking young man who was hobbling painfully around mile 14. He had scribbled a sign on the back of his t-shirt, "Don't laugh, I didn't train for this race." And it made me laugh and think of how I can have all these expectations of myself to be holy and Christ-like when sometimes I'm really just winging it, not studying the Word or seeking God's face through prayer. To run the race in such a way as to win, well, that takes training and discipline, Not that I can get to heaven through an ounce of my own strength, but I want to be ready to meet Christ. I want my entire life to be about preparing for that glorious event. To live like Timothy suggests, being diligent to present yourself approved to God as a workman who does not need to be ashamed, accurately handling the word of truth. While training for my first marathon, friends would ask me, "What's your goal? Do you want to finish the marathon under a certain number of hours?" And I'd tell them, "Look, my main goal is to not lose control of my bowels during the race." Perhaps I watch too many dehydrated Ironman participants on TV, you know, flailing and spewing all sorts of things as they cross the finish line. Initially, anyway, this was a real concern. My marathon guide told me not to worry about my time, but that my goal should simply be to finish. Still, I couldn't help but want to finish well. The Bible tells us to run in such a way as to get the prize. As a believer, I know I need to press on toward the goal to win the prize for which God has called me heavenward in Christ Jesus. The journey of the Christian life really is like a marathon. Sometimes you feel like you can do this. You're trained, you're strong, you're ready. And other times you can only focus on your pain or fatigue or wonder when the journey will end. Praise God, we don't have to rely on what we feel, but live securely in the truth that Christ has won the race for our sakes. A marathon finisher's medal will tarnish, but the crown of life Jesus gives us will last for eternity.
I've got a lot of faith in you. No, I would never stray from you. It's bright outside, but as soon as the darkness comes, and as soon as the teardrops fall, I run.
Opening up this week's Boundless Inbox, I have Candace with me in the studio to answer a question from a listener named Leslie. And Leslie asks, "I am engaged to one of the most amazing men I've ever known. He loves the Lord, is kind, gentle, takes his responsibility as a future husband and father seriously, and loves me for who I am. I've taken much encouragement from Boundless articles to not follow or be distracted by the world system of choosing a mate, and to know that marriage is a cultivating ground for a deeper level of selflessness and holiness. I was definitely one of those women who was preoccupied by fantasies put out there by the media and initially judged him because he didn't meet certain personality and social, quote, standards. As I've surrendered to the Lord, I've come to see that many of those requirements are superficial and don't always reveal the true character of a person. So I'm content in my decision to marry him because of the truth and depth of his character and the integrity he's shown. My only hang-up at this point is that we're in a long-distance relationship and have been for the duration of our 2 years together. As marriage approaches, I find myself nervous because I sometimes worry that our being apart has not allowed us to truly be a couple, together for an extended amount of time, more than just a few days or weekend, and I wonder if our not being able to literally see each other on a day-to-day basis will prove to bring up surprises later in marriage. What do you think about this? Is this just misplaced fear? Should I postpone our possible marriage until we've had more time to spend together in the same city and environment? Or is this normal and I should proceed with marrying him, knowing that all marriages have their things to work out?"
Leslie, you've raised some really good issues. And the first is we're in a bit of a bind because we don't know how far apart you live and we don't know how often you get to be together for a couple of days or a weekend. And so I'm going to just try to take a stab at this, not really knowing what long distance means, by encouraging you that throughout history, people have lived in different cities and been separated by distance for the majority of their relationship and have gone on to have successful marriages. So I don't think on its face that spending your engagement season and even your courtship season in different cities is necessarily a problem or even a reason to postpone the wedding. However, if we were sitting down for coffee, I would be able to ask you some questions. And so what I would want to know is, why do you still live in different cities? Are you waiting to move to where he is because you're finishing out a job? Or is he finishing up a degree? Are you planning to move to his city or to your city? We don't really know where you're headed after the wedding. If you're just staying apart, arbitrarily waiting for the wedding, I would say, why not, wherever you're going to end up, be it you moving his way or he moving your way, why don't you go ahead and do that now? Certainly don't move in together. But if, for example, Leslie, you were planning to get to move to his city once you are married, why not do that ahead of the wedding and stay with someone in his church, for example, and do have a couple of weeks or months together before the wedding? That's not a bad idea if it's logistically possible. The other thing I would encourage you to do is to not let all of your time together be focused on the wedding. You need to do what's necessary to make your wedding special. That's important. But what's even more important is working on the marriage that will follow. And so make sure that you're not spending all your time together on the phone and all your time together when you are in the same city, focused exclusively on the details of the planning of this one day, because that will really detract from the health of your relationship. The third thing is to say, yes, you will be surprised in marriage. And that would happen if you lived next door to each other, because going from courting to living in the same home day in and day out will inevitably produce surprises. There's no way around that. But some good premarital counseling can help mitigate those surprises, and especially if you focus on talking about expectations. And I think this is going to be critical, because you've been in different cities. You haven't necessarily been able to watch one another do day-to-day things like grocery shop and dry cleaning. You may not know, you know, what his threshold is for sleeping in the morning and versus yours for staying up late at night. You may not have all that information. So it would be really helpful to talk through what your expectations are going to be for marriage, so that you can start getting in reality now, even if you're not in the same city. One other thing I would say to encourage you is that I sense that you feel like you're missing out on something by not having the traditional opportunity to be on a date every Friday night, to go to the same church. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's certainly not a deal breaker. There are benefits to being in the same town, but there are also added temptations and added challenges to acting like you're married before you really are. So I don't think it's a deal breaker. It may be just butterflies and nerves. If there are some deeper issues that are really giving you pause and you're thinking, man, if I can't see him in his day-to-day context, I'm just not sure I should move forward, then of course, get some counsel and talk to him about the possibility of postponing just so long enough so that you can be in the same town for a while.
Thanks, Candace. That's it for this week's edition of The Boundless Inbox. Send us your questions and your comments, as always, to editor@boundless.org. We want to hear from you, and we want to address any questions that you might have related to this or completely different. We're always open to receiving those, so do contact us. And that's it for this week's show. Until next week, I'm your host, Lisa Anderson. Have a great week, and we'll see you around next time.
The Boundless Show is a production of boundless.org. Focus on the family.